You found it. The best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson. Stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Five minutes after 8 o'clock, the Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio, 570 KVI. Some people think the most influential left-of-center political fixture in Washington State is sitting 4 feet from me. He is not a politician. He is not a business magnate. He is a union leader and a social issue crusader. David Rolfe in our studios, the leader of Service Employees International 775, Local 775, also the author of a brand new book, The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for a Working America. Good to have you on the show again. We've had you on the show before, David, but we've never had you in studio.
Oh, no, I actually, well...
Did we?
We co-hosted a show once when Ken Schramm was on vacation.
Oh, that's right. You were one of our... That was on Como.
Yeah.
That was on Como.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds
that's right.
Right. Many years ago. But I'm really happy to be back.
Yes. Well, no, it's good having you here. Get as close to that microphone as you can, because we got to talk about a bunch of stuff. The first thing we have to talk about is the food fight on the left, the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Where are you?
Well, I support Hillary Clinton.
Sellout!
I think Hillary Clinton is ready to be the president. She is, by the way, for every actual fight for 15 that's occurred so far in the country. And
yeah, but who was there first, David Rolfe?
Well, Congressman Adam Smith here from Washington State was probably the very first member of Congress to support $15 campaign when he endorsed the initiative in SeaTac. Mm-hmm. And I remind people who... you know, across the country, sometimes criticize SEIU for, why aren't you for Bernie? Well, you know, listen, Bernie's a great candidate, and I think the debate is good for the Democratic Party. But it wasn't actually a far-left, you know, congressman from L.A. or San Francisco or Chicago or New York who first endorsed minimum wage. It was actually a centrist from right here in Washington State, Congressman Adam Smith, whose father worked at SeaTac, a guy named Ben Smith, made a good living with a pension and health care and was able to not use government assistance but still put his kids through school and buy a home because he had a good blue-collar job in the 1970s. And those jobs are increasingly the same jobs, same airport, same economy, but still making now making minimum wage.
So you must be supporting Donald Trump then if
Well, like I said,
he's going to bring back all those factory jobs.
Well, I don't know that those jobs
actually,
are coming
back. Actually, let me ask. I'm being snarky, but let me ask you very seriously.
Yeah, sure.
How do you and your members feel about Donald Trump? Donald Trump wants, for the most part, a non-interventionist foreign policy. Donald Trump, for the most part, wants to radically rewrite our trade agreements, and he wants a focus on union jobs here in the industrial heartland. And one of his key reasons for supporting a tougher stance on illegal immigration is he said American working class employees are losing hours, losing jobs, losing opportunities, losing wages to a flooded applicant pool where employers like the U.S. Chamber, you know, support illegal immigration.
Well, you know, I think Donald Trump has tapped into some righteous anger out there in America, and I think that working class people around the country have a right to be mad. I strongly disagree, though, with who Donald Trump is mad at. I don't think the appropriate targets are Mexican immigrants. I don't think the appropriate targets are Muslim immigrants. I think that Donald Trump, at the end of the day, doesn't believe in much other than himself. And while he may pay lip service to wanting good jobs, he's actively fighting a campaign by his own housekeepers and servers at one of his Vegas hotels to form a union. So I don't think Donald Trump is any friend of the working man. I think Donald Trump is a friend of Donald Trump.
If very interesting. Did you see the Seattle Times profile on the two machinists?
I did, yeah.
It was very interesting. One of them wouldn't surprise me very much. It's a guy in his 60s. Married for 44 years, your prototypical blue-collar conservative, who doesn't like big government. The surprise to me was the 30-year-old who grew up in a union household. His mother, I think, was a recorder for the Boeing Machinists Union. And he voted for Obama in 2008, and he likes Trump. And the interesting part of the interview for me, David Rolfe, was when he said that most of the people on my work crew are for Trump, and Trump's got about up to half the vote in the plant, and many of the other workers like Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I remember in the 1988 election, it was the first election I could vote in, and my grandfather, who was an eighth grade educated blue collar guy who spent the last 25 years of his working life on an assembly line at General Motors, I asked him what he was planning on doing in the Ohio primary. Now, in the Ohio primary, you ask for a Republican or a Democratic ballot when you walk in the polling place.
Right.
So no party registration. You pick one party or the other on the day of the election. And he said, you know, I'm not sure yet, because my church really wants me to vote for Pat Robertson, and my union really wants me to vote for Jesse Jackson. Now, what that tells you is that Americans don't exist on some sort of Washington, D.C. beltway, bilateral x-axis of left versus right. They are attracted to the candidates who speak to their hopes and their fears and their values. And that deeply pro-union, deeply Christian man wasn't quite sure.
So which preacher did he vote for?
I never learned what he did when he went into his private polling place or voting booth and cast his ballot. But what I do know is that...
Are you taking flack for supporting Hillary over Bernie?
Oh, sure.
Aren't most of your members for Bernie?
We did a number of polls in SEIU, and even in Washington State, Hillary had a slight advantage over Bernie Sanders among SEIU members in Washington State. Nationally, it was a larger gap. So, you know, we did listen to our members on this. We had a number of conversations with the elected rank-and-file leadership of the union.
Now, this surprises me a little bit, because you and I were talking about this right before. You had me over as a guest speaker to your union. Was it your executive board?
Yeah, executive board.
And this was in 2007.
Right.
And in 2007, everyone thought, you know, Hillary is the inevitable Democratic nominee. And I was surprised when you went around the table and there was just a complete lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, but a bubbling up of excitement for this newly elected senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. And I thought, wow, I don't think Hillary has the base at all, like a lot of people assume. And so I'm a little surprised to hear that here we are now, 8 years later. And if anything, you know, here's Hillary, the speeches at Goldman Sachs, the multimillion-dollar contributions of the Clinton Foundation and all that. She's running against someone who's even more of a liberal purist than Barack Obama. And you say your members are now more pro-Clinton than they were back then.
I think that her service as Secretary of State and the different profile she ended up
with. She was a disaster.
Well, okay, you and I can debate foreign policy. Well, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on that. I'm a union leader. But listen, I think that today, you know, what our internal surveys and polls showed was that our members had a slight preference for Hillary over Bernie. And by the way, didn't really dislike either of these candidates. I think what's going on right now in the Democratic Party is a good debate. And historically, you know, I don't think it's bad at all to have a little inter-party competition about ideas.
Let me give you my take, and you can tell me why I'm wrong here.
Okay.
I view Bernie Sanders as a Democratic Goldwater. Back in 1964, Barry Goldwater decided he wanted to seize control of the Republican Party from the establishment wing led by Nelson Rockefeller and, you know, the back east crowd, and make it a Western conservative party.
Yes.
And he knew he was going to get killed in the election against Johnson, but he said, we'll win the party and we can build on it. Because Goldwater was about a movement. He wasn't about just getting the job. And sure enough, eventually, it took a while to count those votes. Ronald Reagan gets the nomination 16 years later, and the Republican Party becomes a conservative party, more or less. Bernie Sanders, to me, looks like someone leading a movement. Someone who is not in it for the glory. He's not in it for the job. He can't be bought off, you know, by dangling the vice presidency or a big appointment in front of him. He wants to make the party a left-wing party. So I can see more turmoil than a lot of people might think at the convention in Philadelphia, because you have a guy who really is a movement guy.
Yeah, you know, both parties over a period of generations have had these candidates that have emerged as people trying to lead movements from within the political party structure rather than from outside it. And, you know, you mentioned Barry Goldwater on the Republican side. Ronald Reagan in 76, as opposed to 1980, might fall into that category. Pat Robertson, Pat Buchanan, Mike Huckabee even, examples of people who were unlikely, based on their profile, to appeal to swing voters in swing states in a November election, but who had were crusading for a group of ideas. And on the Democratic side, you certainly had McGovern in that category. You had others, I mean, Jesse Jackson, Howard Dean, these insurgent left candidates, John Edwards, until his own personal troubles sort of got him out of the way. But I think that, at least I'll reflect from the progressive movement side, I think we make a mistake when we believe that candidates can be movement leaders. You know, FDR needed a David Dubinsky on his left to make him an effective president for the cause of organized labor in the 1930s, and LBJ needed a Martin Luther King on his left to make him an effective leader for civil rights in the 1960s.
Are you listening to John Carlson? My guest, David Rolfe, the head of SEIU, Local 775. Some say the most influential unelected person. He's not an elected official. He's an elected union.
He's
an elected union president. Also the author of the new book, The Fight for 15, The Right Wage for a Working America. Is he right about that? We're about to talk about it here. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Back we are. John Carlson, David Rolfe.
Hi.
From Service Employees International 775, the man behind the cause, the $15 an hour minimum wage. Let me ask real quickly, how much would be too much?
You know, I don't know.
How do you know 15 is good? How do you know that's not too much?
What we know is that A, 15 doesn't actually even do the job as far as letting an adult live a life free, totally self-sufficient in King County. And we looked at market basket data on the Mayor's Income and Inequality Advisory Committee on the real cost of even a single adult living a self-sufficient life in King County. And 15 doesn't even quite get there, much less a parent who has to support children.
Yeah, but when has a starting wage ever been enough to live on? Well, when I was a kid, the minimum wage was, I think, $2.25 an hour. That wasn't enough to live on in the 70s.
You know, when my mother went to college in the 50s and 60s, she could work 7 weeks.
There was no minimum wage, was there?
There was. We've had a minimum wage since 1937.
What was it, about 50 cents an hour?
It peaked in value in today's dollars in 1968. But when people went to college in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they could work 7 weeks of the summer at a minimum wage job and pay for tuition for the following year. What we've seen over the last...
You know why? Because the state of Washington was covering 87% of their tuition. Well, that's why.
Well, we can talk about tuition. We can talk about health care costs.
No,
we can talk about retirement. We can talk about any number of things. The reality is there's been a 40-year war on workers in this country. We have seen the spending power of the bottom 50% erode. We've seen the bottom 90% of income earners have to take a pay freeze for the last 40 years, with the exception of a couple years in the late 90s. And we've seen more wealth created in the last 30 years than was created in all of human history. And we've concentrated almost all of that, about 95%, with the top 1% of income earners. So what $15 does, Ron Unz, who ran for...
We had him on the show.
Yeah. He says $15 is conservative rocket fuel.
Because it lowers
dependence on government programs, because it gives businesses new customers, because it lets you increase tax collections without raising marginal rates, and because all the jobs that could be exported have already been.
Well, here's where I come from on the minimum wage. I don't come at an academic angle. Mm-hmm. I come at it from where I grew up. I grew up in West Seattle. My first job was summer of 1970, picking strawberries at age 11. I got $24 and I think 72 cents for the summer, because all they needed was at the most a flat of strawberries a day for the local market. But, you know, it was money. Then I found out that I could earn more than that in a month as a paper boy. So I did that for 2 years. Then I got a job scooping ice cream at Baskin Robbins for $1.75. Then I found I could get $2.25 an hour at the butcher shop, even though it was grimy, dirty, smelly work. It was $2.25 an hour in 1975. And I eventually left that job to work at True Value Hardware for $2.50 an hour. My point here, David, is none of those jobs paid a living wage, but they were a starting wage. Yeah. And then I got more responsibility and I got better jobs and experience along the way. And I'm wondering how many of those jobs would exist if there was a $15 an hour minimum wage equivalent back then. I'm guessing none of them.
Well, there are two things you're addressing here. They're separate, but they're related. One is the question of who is working minimum wage jobs and low wage jobs. And it used to be 50s, 60s, 70s, primarily teenagers, or significantly teenagers, people in their first or second jobs, people probably still living with their parents, people who were saving for college, saving for spending money. And that was true when we reflect back on, you know, sort of that sitcom era, Happy Days, Archie Bunker period of our history. But today, only 7.3% of, I'm sorry, I was reading the wrong statistic, only 16% of the workers who make less than $15 an hour are under 20 years old. 25% of them are between 35 and 49 years old. 25% of them are moms.
But they might be supplemental jobs, David. They might be, well, let's supplement the family income by having someone take a part-time job.
Well, only because there's been a 40-year wage freeze in this country, and the family that used to be able to live on one income in the 1970s now needs two to three incomes in order to live the same lifestyle. And that's not something anyone would have voted for in the 1976 elections.
But if those jobs go away, how do they live?
But first of all, they don't go away. We looked at every data point we could find. And when, for example, first of all, you look from 1937 to today. Now, in 1937, the head of the American Publishers Association testified before Congress that if Congress implemented a minimum wage, America would fall like ancient Rome. That was his prediction, his words, in 1937. Now, America's still here. We've had dozens of federal minimum wage increases. 82% of the time, they correlate with an increase in overall employment. 18% of the time, they have correlated with no meaningful change in employment. And 0%, that's 0% of the time, they've correlated with a decline in employment.
Do you know where the highest minimum wage, entry-level minimum wage is in America right now?
Right now, it's, Seattle.
No.
Seattle. $13 for the large businesses in Seattle.
The highest minimum wage, David, is in a state with a $7.70 minimum wage. But it's not the market wage. If you want to work in the Bakken oil field area of North Dakota, you are going to get an entry-level job of anywhere from $12 to $18 an hour because of the market. It's not government that creates higher wages. It's economic growth.
Government's doing it right here, John.
What?
We did it. Government's doing it right here in Seattle. We passed a law that says large businesses today have to pay $13 an hour minimum to their employees.
And what happens when you find out that growth is more stagnant among entry-level jobs or even lost jobs?
But that's not the data. That's not what the data shows anywhere in the country. Even when you look at cross-border situations like Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, when Washington State raises our wage, do you think businesses go to Idaho? On the opposite happens. Workers come to apply for jobs in Washington.
The book is The Fight for 15. David Rolfe, my guest here, Talk Radio 570 KVI.